Okay, there we go. Today we're here with Joe Bryan. I think this is the fourth episode of the Bitcoin Youth Podcast, and I think by now everyone knows who you are, but do you want to introduce yourself just in case?
Oh, well, thank you, Harley, for having me on. And my name is Joe Bryan. I've recently created a video called What's the Problem, which a number of people have seen. And if you're watching this and haven't seen it, please maybe pause this, go watch it, and then come back. I'm delighted to have been invited on to the Bitcoin Youth podcast, and hopefully going to have some interesting questions.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for coming. I'm very lucky to have you. I mean, you've been on some big ones already. You've been on Walkers, Daniel Prince's. I mean, that must have been pretty cool.
It's been a surreal few weeks,
Yeah, I bet.
and there's another big one to come as well,
Oh, yeah?
in a few weeks. So,
That's a nice tease.
but you know, but Harley, this is the one I've been looking forward to.
Well, yeah, of
So,
course, of course.
yeah.
No, that's like every Bitcoiner's dream, I guess, to be on the Bitcoin podcast.
Why on the Bitcoin Youth podcast? Absolutely,
Oh, of course, yeah, the bigger one, obviously,
the big one.
yeah.
But no, this is great, and I've a lot of respect for what it is you're trying to do here.
Thank you.
We need more young people
We do.
coming into Bitcoin
We do.
and giving a platform to bring people from within the Bitcoin community to the audience of your age group and there and thereabouts is fantastic. So
Yeah, that's the
I'm very
goal.
happy to be able to
Yeah.
support.
And we do have some comments today from people of my age group about your video. And they are not particularly Bitcoiners.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I
This
did
could go
echo.
one of two ways, Harley.
I know. I did economics with these guys in school in A levels, which was an awful, awful economics A level in the UK is the most atrocious form of education that anyone could ever go through. But it'll be interesting. Yeah. So we're going to start with the first response from my friend who I'm not going to say his name, but very smart guy at a very esteemed university in the UK for economics related studies. And he said, "Okay, I watched the video. My fundamental issue with the idea is that I believe it to be completely theoretical. He's unhappy with the amount of assumptions that it makes, assuming that a constant money supply would incentivize hard work from workers slash consumers, leading to a more efficient economy. I think that it is unrealistic about actual consumer behavior, and I think that some individuals will respond in that way, but others will find it too hard to attain any money as it is of a more value than weak money, and that weak money by being more readily available to obtain, contributes to greater activity rates in the economy." So I do have
Okay,
my
well,
response, but I would love to hear what you have to say to that.
so this is a great question, and it is. Thank you to your friend for asking this, who will remain nameless.
Yeah.
But it's a question I get often in response to this video, typically from people who have had a formal education in Keynesian economics, which is the basis of anything that gets taught in the Western world pretty much these days, unless you go and find out how to actually do it properly through the Austrian school. But the fundamental, his entire question is based on the assumption that weak money is a good thing and that the stimulation of spending that that creates is a good thing, which is absolutely not the case. And so if we just think about it, if you're given a choice between hard money and a weak money, and just for the audience, hard money is one where you maintain your purchasing power, and a weak money is one where your purchasing power gets gradually or more rapidly removed through inflation. And so when you
Inflation
go out,
being the increase in that money supply.
So the inflation comes is the increase in the money supply, and that manifests itself as a decrease in the purchasing power that your money has over time. And we all know this because we'll put money in the bank and then 12 months later it doesn't quite buy what it bought a year ago. And mm-hmm. and you can't save in pounds.
Yeah.
But think about what's actually happening there. You're going out and doing a day's work and you're expending energy, your energy, and you're converting that into economic energy. And then you want to be able to store that economic energy. So your money is like a battery, right? You want it to store that economic energy to be able to use at some point in the future as and when you choose to use it. Now, in a fair system, that battery shouldn't decay
mm-hmm.
because you've already done the work. You've already done the work and you've been taxed on the work.
Yeah.
You should be able to retain the purchasing power of that into the future and be able to draw on it whenever you need without having to take additional risks with it just to try and retain the purchasing power, which is what happens with fiat money. And so when you diverge and move to weak money, your whole thought process changes because you know you can't keep it in the bank. You know you can't save it. So what does that do? It forces you to spend it. And if you're forced to spend something, then you're going to make poorer decisions. This is why we see the growth of consumerism and, you know, living your best life and these sorts of things coming into the general
culture.
Just society as a whole. Yeah. as a whole. People are focused on shorter term because you can't rely on the money being there. And, you know, one of the key points here is really inflation versus deflation. So hard money, in theory, you could say just maintain your purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
But reality is, if you are on a hard money standard, when you have a free market backdrop, productivity gains drives prices lower. And so your purchasing power actually goes up over time to the benefit of everybody,
mm-hmm.
which is the normal state of the world. And so to frame all of economics on the need for inflation, the need to steal money from people, to corrupt their decision-making, to force them to spend money in unproductive ways, and having that as a basis of economics is misguided at best.
Insane. Absolutely.
Deliberately insane.
Broadly insane, yeah.
Broadly insane. And this doesn't take an economic genius to figure out. It's just human action.
Mm-hmm. That's what it's I really action. Dislike about,
yeah.
you know, some people saying they have, like, going to university for a PhD in economics. It almost creates the idea that it's super difficult to understand. It's really the necessity to understand for everyone. It should not be reserved for some people.
Well, that's right, but you can break economics. I mean, modern economics is not scientific. Mm-hmm. And a lot of academic study in university is credentialism, effectively the higher you go. It's mm-hmm. people marking their own homework, never having to actually be tested in the real world.
Yeah.
Whereas you talk to anybody who's run a business, you know, who's thought about the human action of spending, has even for 5 minutes thought about how their own decision-making works, they very quickly come to the understanding that Austrian economics is just how things work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Keynesian I don't want to go on trashing Keynesianism, but just break it down for yourself and think about your decision making. And one of the key arguments tends to be, but the economy would slow.
Mm-hmm.
People would spend less and the economy would slow if you're on a hard money standard.
Yeah.
But I think it's about timescales. And I think it's about quality of growth.
Yeah, I also think there's definitely... Sorry, you go.
No, please.
Okay, I was going to say there's also an argument to say that you could invest, but that would be an increase in demand in the economy, which would be higher prices, as opposed to not spending, which would be would result in lower demand to the alternative and therefore lower prices to the alternative, which would encourage activity, and that you'd have more ventures would seem more profitable, and then you'd have that activity spurred by lower prices as opposed to desperate spending.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is lacking is second order thinking here.
Mm-hmm.
Just spending money is not good for the economy, especially if it's on consumption. You want spending in investment. And so you think about yourself, if you are able to store your economic energy for when you need it, it means that you're not forced into short-term decision-making. Every purchase you make, you then question whether, do I really need this? Or can I put it to more productive use? Because there is an alternative where you just save it. That alternative doesn't really exist here. Yeah. And so you're forced into doing it, which compromises your decision-making. And so, yes, consumer spending would drop on consumer-driven items, on consumption. But we would create a greater pool of capital for investment. Investment is driven from savings.
Mm-hmm.
And as we accumulate more savings from making better decisions, we have the capital to invest in the future for long-term growth. And as you say, if you combine hard money with a free market, and Bitcoin has both of those things built in, then what happens over time is you harness the productivity of everybody, which drives prices down. And so yeah. As prices fall, your productivity, your ability to spend more effectively increases further because you have to spend less to buy the same amount of goods.
Yeah.
And your savings have more power into the future because they have greater purchasing power, greater investment capability. And so it's a trade-off between the short-term growth and long-term growth.
Mm-hmm.
And my argument would be, if we switch to a hard money standard overnight, if we switch to Bitcoin overnight, you would absolutely see a drop in customer and consumer spending. But years out, the economy would be in a much stronger position because the quality of investments will be a lot higher. Because the price of money hasn't been corrupted.
Yeah.
The investments, the companies raising capital to undergo speculative ventures would be higher quality companies because the price of money would be fair. You would remove the funding of structurally unprofitable businesses that are kept alive by the decaying money.
Yeah.
And so I would ask your friend to go back and just question the first principles under his question.
Yeah, and there's definitely something to be said for how he claims that some people wouldn't work because money is too hard to attain, but I think the incentive to survive is a pretty strong one in and of itself, I think. You're not going to give up your opportunity to live because the money is too hard to get a hold of, I think. Yeah.
Well, just think about what else he's saying. So, if we steal from people, we'll incentivize them to work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that just doesn't work.
Yeah. That doesn't work. And I mean, hard money enables you to maintain purpose.
Yeah.
You see a much clearer link between your input and output as a human being because you can rely upon it, which allows you to make longer term decision making.
Yeah.
So hopefully that answers the question for him.
Yeah, hopefully. I'll let you know what he says in reply.
we'll do the follow-up on part two.
I mean, he also has some other comments. We did have a little argument over what causes inflation, and he says there are more factors than just an increase in the money supply that cause inflation, such as global disasters and, what did he say? Global disasters, increasing in demand and supply.
Yeah, so there is a difference here. So when we talk about inflation is different from demand supply changes. Demand supply changes is just what happens in a free market.
Mm-hmm.
When the prices drop, we don't say there's deflation in an individual good, right? Now, what he's saying is drawing the distinction, is lumping in demand and supply under inflation.
Yeah.
Now, if you talk about goods in aggregate, then they're one and the same thing. If you talk about goods individually or in small groups, they are not necessarily one and the same thing, because you could have an increase in supply and one good come to the market through an external factor and the prices there drop. That is just the free market doing its thing.
Right? Yeah.
Inflation is the general increase in the price of goods as a whole. Right? And this is what is driven from money printing. This is what it's driven from money printing.
Yeah.
When you have a natural disaster or something like that, that can cause short-term dislocations in markets, which is effectively just impacting the demand and supply.
Yeah.
But that's just the free market. That's not inflation.
Yeah, yeah. Which is what I tried to get across to him. And he seemed to... Yeah. Well, I think it's easy to get confused because the modern inflation numbers that we receive... that we are given, you know, supplied by mass media and government institutions do incorporate increases in demand and supply. They don't measure the increase in money supply. They say, inflation is high because of disruptions in, during COVID. Distributions in supply and like constraints in supply. But that's not, they factor it into inflation measures, but it's not inflation, which I think confuses a lot of people.
Absolutely, and deliberately so.
Yeah,
Holly.
I mean, deliberately
so. If it was, the prices were changing in aggregate due to demand and supply aggregate changes, prices should go down sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You see, you just think about it critically. If it is demand and supply, it's not just demand, right? There is a supply element, so why do prices never fall?
Yeah,
it's because that's not what's driving the price changes.
Yeah,
you know, the reality is in a free market, prices decline naturally through technological innovation, and we see this. We see this in certain goods and services, like the price of TVs or computers, for example. We see the prices for the same thing decline. Sometimes it's masked because the quality increases. And so the price doesn't look like it's going down, but the next version is five times better than the last version. But technology drives deflation.
Yeah.
But we live in a world around us where all we see is inflation, and that is because of the distortion of the price signals, because of the money printing.
And it's important. It's important to note that the prices of the things we need to live do not have the same effects of deflation in our current economy as. Technologies. So I mean, food and housing does not benefit from that because there's less room to improve on technology for building houses and for creating food than there is for TVs.
I would add something to that. I mean, food is one area where we've had a lot of centralization driven from regulations and the distortion of the money supply.
Yeah.
And so that's been combined with the reduction in the quality. Yeah. And so, you know, it leads to the health crises and all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But housing in particular, we don't see it go down, not because it shouldn't go down in a free market. It doesn't go down because it's been monetized.
Yeah.
And for the audience, what that means is we know we can't keep our money in the bank. It's rotting. You can't keep it in the bank, but you know, most of us realize that if you leave it in the bank 10 years, it's going to lose half its value. So what do you do? I mean, you're probably not at the stage in life where you're thinking about buying a house or you know, buying a second home or an investment property or something like that. But this is what the older generations end up thinking through, because they accumulate some savings. They want to find a battery to store that economic energy into the future, and they realize cash is not the answer. And so what do you do is quite often, especially in the UK, is you buy a rental property.
Right? Or you buy something that can be created less fast than they create the money.
Exactly. Exactly. And so there is a combination of cultural, like using housing as a proxy for hard money, but also a cultural thing around, well, everybody does it and we talk about it, and therefore that becomes more of an asset to store it in. And in some countries it would be more gold or it would be something else. But that's why prices don't go down. You know, once Bitcoin is Bitcoin is slowly eating the world, and it will demonetize all of these assets over time. And when Bitcoin has demonetized housing will return to be primarily a utility good.
Mm-hmm.
Because people won't buy it to store wealth in it, because that's a really inefficient battery.
Yeah.
You use the most efficient battery, which mm-hmm. is Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And so all of that excess monetary premium in the housing market will slowly come down. So judging housing inflation specifically around the cost of housing over time is a very, very distorted measure.
Yeah.
Outside of technological innovation, because it's monetized and it's driven by debt as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ever lower standards, ever greater leverage, ever lower standards of lending.
Yeah. Yeah. So we can move on from that friend now. I think he has more than enough to think about.
All right, great.
Yeah. So then I had a response for another one of my friends who is in finance, you know, got a nice internship with a big company in London. And he watched the video and he came around. He messaged me. The first thing he said after he watched it, he said, "The video was great. I now understand why Bitcoin is better than fiat, but I just don't see how we make that shift." He just can't see how we actually go from using fiat and using our credit cards and using our debit cards in everyday payment to then using Bitcoin as payment. And do you have any opinions?
That's a more specific question. So is his question around Bitcoin adoption in general, or is it more around usage as payments?
Just more about usage as payments. How do we get from that world where just fiat no longer exists? It just becomes irrelevant.
Okay. But that's a combination of things then. So money typically has three stages, and the first is store of value, which then leads to medium of exchange, which then leads to unit of account. Yeah. And unit of account means you go into a shop and you see all the prices in Bitcoin. Like, we are clearly not at that stage yet.
Mm-hmm.
We are just creeping into the stage of medium of exchange. So there are a number of businesses in the UK and around the world that you can pay in Bitcoin at. Now, this still remains the minority. This is very much so. But I would say the businesses that do adopt it get a inherent competitive advantage. And this competitive advantage will continue to increase over time as more and more people adopt Bitcoin and they stand out as merchants that Bitcoiners then want to support, as opposed to the fiat merchants, which you know, we already know this as Bitcoiners. But we're still at the store of value predominant stage.
Yeah.
And you can tell this by the fact that Bitcoin is still around a tenth the value of gold. Bitcoin beats gold on every metric you would care to think about it.
Yeah.
And yet it's a tenth of the value. And it's not just digital gold, it's so much more than that. And so you have a sense as to how early we are in this process. But this process is going to take decades. But it's a process that everybody unilaterally can opt into. Hartley, you've opted into it, I've opted into it.
Yeah.
Everybody will opt into it at some point. And so what we will see is slowly, suddenly, because you reach a sort of critical early mass of people where they begin to share their knowledge with other people, begin to be driven by their alignment to Bitcoin in their daily habits, in their spending, in their communications, in their preferences. Yeah. And naturally, the free market will respond to that. Businesses that start accepting Bitcoin and start appealing to the Bitcoin audience will outperform those that don't.
Yeah.
And when naturally that happens, another business will copy them, then another business will copy, another business will copy them.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we eradicate fiat.
Yeah.
But it's one day at a time, and it's a very, very gradual process driven by individuals.
Painfully slow.
And so, very slow, but it's going to, at some point, there will be big upticks where... Yeah. A government makes a more friendly business environment for Bitcoin, or a Bitcoiner in a company changes their product to unlock something which is Bitcoin native.
Yeah.
And there are going to be these steps along the way. So to your friend, it's going to be a long time. It's a gradual process, but payments already exist and they're better for merchants.
Yes. Which I think is really also another thing that's also hard for people to see is that we don't feel like we're paying the extortionate fees that current debit cards and, you know, all of those things charge, because they charge the merchants, and most people aren't merchants. So they don't realize that as much as they don't feel like they're paying those fees, they're definitely being passed on.
Yeah, absolutely. They're passed on in the sticker price.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, they're a world with Bitcoin is a cheaper world for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's also a better world for everybody in terms of finality. So when you pay the merchant, the money leaves your account immediately.
Yeah.
But the merchant doesn't get it immediately. Mm-hmm. They'll get it at some point minus the fees, and it'll be you know, 3 days later or a week later.
Yeah.
But that payment can also be reversed. And so paying in Bitcoin is akin to paying in cash. Businesses like to receive cash. Small businesses especially, because then they don't have to pay the fees on it.
Yeah.
We have a financial system that's stock full of middlemen taking small chunks out of every payment.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if a payment moves enough, the middlemen take it all.
Yeah.
Gradually. Slowly. And so, yeah, Bitcoin is just digital cash.
Mm-hmm.
Peer-to-peer digital cash. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it all makes me think a lot of competition. There's so much in fiat which suppresses competition. One, through that same nominal fee for a small business is a much higher percentage of profits. And the fact that assets have stocks and stuff like that have been monetized for large companies, which just gives them a huge unfair advantage, which ruins the free market entirely when you have no competition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the aggregation of investment in ever bigger entities allows them access to cheaper and cheaper financing,
mm-hmm.
which means that they can buy back their stock, or they can buy competitors, or they can cut their prices artificially to squeeze out competitors, or they can work with the government to put up barriers of regulation around their industries to stop people competing. And this is exactly what we see. We see this
protect
everywhere.
Protect consumers.
You've got to protect those consumers.
Yeah. Obviously. But yeah, this leads me nicely into what I've been thinking about most for about the past week, and pretty much has not left my mind.
Okay.
So many people now, I feel, have forgotten Medium Exchange and what I consider that to be the most important step at some point. But I've asked the question to a couple of people: can Bitcoin succeed as a store of value and not as a medium, like without being a medium exchange ever? And Michael Saylor's change in tone to being Bitcoin dollar resonates with people now moving towards believing that it's just going to be a store of value, which I completely disagree with, but I'll let you say your piece.
I think there's several ways to answer this. Can Bitcoin succeed purely as a store of value? Absolutely. Will it stop at just being a store of value? Absolutely not. And so, you know, gold is a store of value. It is not a medium of exchange in most places around the world.
Yeah.
Right. And so can Bitcoin eat gold's lunch? Absolutely. But it's just going to do so much more than that. And so, you know, bear in mind that we live in an existing fiat system, and the long game here is to try and build as many links as possible between the fiat and Bitcoin systems to help the Bitcoin system get monetized as quickly as possible to destroy the old system.
Yeah.
Okay. And so quite often it would not serve to say, you know, to try and destroy those links. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'll maybe put some of the comments in context, I would say. Absolutely, Bitcoin is going to become medium of exchange, and it's ultimately going to become unit of account. This is already inevitable in the long span of time. It's just a question of how long it takes and the path it takes.
Yeah.
From a medium of exchange perspective, it is neutral money for the world and is non-jurisdictional. So it will unlock a level of prosperity for the world that has been previously unimaginable, because it removes all those middlemen. It allows the poorer parts of the world to monetize their services directly at higher prices to the Western world. And yeah, I mean, like you, I just don't see it stopping at store value.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to stop at store value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's more politically acceptable to say so.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the angle I come at it when I argue with people, which I think pisses them off and puts them off, is that I say it can't. My argument is it can't be. If it's only a store of value, it fails, and it's not. It fails in being a store of value if it never becomes a medium of exchange. And then people say, "What about gold? What about housing?" And then I say that you can bank on someone needing gold for its productive uses in, you know, like conducting electricity or whatever, and in whatever it does, and you can bank on someone needing a house in the future because they need somewhere to live. No one has that desire to hold Bitcoin. The only desire to hold Bitcoin is as money. So I kind of come from my opinion at the moment, I've yet to find a satisfactory argument that it can only be store of value. I think if it fails at being a medium of exchange, it fails as being a store of value as well. But that's my opinion, and I'm still struggling in my thought process.
I would say some of this is often in the framing of the question. It's not a binary thing, Harley. It's already being used as a medium of exchange in some parts of the world. Yeah. And so it's already crossing that gap. And so it's not like it's a rigid box it sits in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And a medium of exchange, again, has different aspects. Just because you can't go into most shops now and pay in Bitcoin doesn't mean it's not a medium of exchange. Because individuals can still transact directly between each other for Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to go through a merchant. It doesn't have to be with a third party. It could just be between Bitcoin holders in value for value exchanges.
Yeah.
And that already happens. So like, we've already started. It already is medium of exchange. It's just the scale to which it's medium of exchange in normie world, I would say.
Yeah, okay.
And so I agree with you, and hopefully that lack of distinct boundaries
allows it's you a much to better way of framing it.
Mind. Yeah.
It's just been bugging me for so long, and I haven't been able to like clock it, and it's played on my mind for ages.
So unfortunately, my Wi-Fi did fail me towards the end there, which is why it cut off so abruptly. But I did get a chance to ask Joe pretty much everything that I wanted to ask him. So huge thank you to him for sparing me some time. And I hope everyone enjoyed the episode.